Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I just spoke with Katie Price about her really wonderful new book, Loving Faster Than Light, Romance and Readers in Einstein's Universe, that was published with the University of Chicago Press in 2012. Now, this is a book that is really rich in a number of different ways. Not only is Katie bringing together in this book a range of kinds of documents and kinds of texts that are all emerging out of the context of a kind of public engagement with ideas about Einsteinian relativity in Britain in the 1920s and 1930s. But she's also bringing to those texts and to those documents a set of analytic tools and a set of methodologies and ways of reading that are informed by both historical and literary ways of engaging with science and engaging with texts. So the result is not just a series of case studies that are all really fascinating in their own extent and that cover newspapers, popular magazines, popular fiction, other kinds of fictional accounts, poems. But she's also weaving them together very coherently with arguments that inform both fields that she's talking to, and at least those two fields, if not more. As a reader, I came away from this not only really fascinated because I learned a ton about not just ways of thinking about the history of science, but also ways of reading documents that come out of the context of the history of science from this text. But also I came away from this wanting to go and read a ton more about all of the characters that emerge in this book because they're so fascinating. And it's a lot of fun also. So there's also for lovers of science fiction or sort of the dimensions of science fiction, pun kind of intended there, there's also a ton of descriptions of really wonderfully funny and interesting stories that come out of the early 20th century engagement with Einsteinian relativity that you might want to go and read the entirety of after reading this book, because it's really, really fun in that way. So it was really a pleasure talking with Katie Price about the book, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Katie Price about her new book, Loving Faster Than Light, Romance and Readers in Einstein's Universe. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Katie, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Katie, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background and yourself? What brought you to the field of the kind of historical and literary study of the sciences?
Well, I got into it through poetry. I was really against studying science in any way because my parents were medical and scientific. So I was firmly convinced that I wanted to study poetry. And I was in my third year of my undergraduate studies. I was doing a free arts program at the University of Manchester, and I decided I was going to write my English dissertation on the poems of William Empson. And I hadn't read his poems. I just thought that he would be an interesting person. So I filled in my form to do my topic, and I think there was a raised eyebrow from my tutor who said, "These poems are a little difficult." But I then read the poems and couldn't understand them at all. And I realized that they'd been inspired by popular astronomy books, many of the poems. So I thought, okay, well, I'll read the astronomy books and see if that helps. And I was hooked from that point, really, reading Arthur Eddington's popular books. They were so much fun, such good storytelling. So I was lured into science that way.
That's totally fascinating. So your interest in this field didn't actually come from a sort of inherent interest in wanting to study the history and philosophy and literature of science. It came through poetry.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So I was going to ask you how you came to this topic in particular, and you just started to get at that, actually. We'll talk a little bit about Empson's poems and Empson as a figure and Eddington as well when we get later on in the conversation and when we start talking about the later chapters of the book for listeners who may not be familiar with their work. But this is part of actually a larger project in the book where you're looking at the what we might call, and I'm going to put this word in air quotes right now, because we'll talk about the kind of complexities of this concept and this word in a little bit, but perhaps popular, so air quotes, reception of and engagement with the theories and the ideas of Einstein in this context. Mm-hmm. So how did you come to framing the project in that way, sort of rather than or moving from popular astronomical works to looking more expansively at the reception of this particular set of ideas at this particular time?
Well, what happened was I was presenting my work on EMSON in History of Science conferences, but my work at this stage was very much within the close reading school of literary criticism. And so it was odd that I was there at a History of Science conference, but they were very welcoming people. And then they said to me, where's the context? And so I thought, oh, I better go away and explore the context so that I can carry on hanging out with these wonderful historians of science who are so much fun. And so I spent at least a year in microfilm reading rooms, reading through newspaper reports of the key ideas that were in Empson's poems. So he was talking about curved space-time and about what happened in Einstein's universe to space travellers. He was using these ideas in his poems. So I thought, okay, I have to look at what happened when these ideas first reached a broad audience. So I went and I looked at newspaper coverage from 1919, when Einstein's theory of relativity was first presented to the public.
Excellent. So this actually transformed into a project that wound up covering not just newspapers, but a vast array, a really wonderfully focused but wonderfully diverse array of different kinds of texts, different sort of ways of structuring argument, different kinds of materials. And we'll get to that in a moment as well. So this is your first book, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about the process of moving from dissertation work to the book itself? Were there any major transformations, any points that were particularly gratifying or particularly difficult or you know, et cetera, et cetera? Can you talk a little bit about that? What was that process like for you?
Yeah, well, it's taken a long time. It's taken about 12 years. And as I mentioned, I was practicing close literary analysis and in my PhD. And it was after the PhD that I began engaging with the history of science and realizing that there was a whole world around the text a lot of different approaches within the history of science. So I didn't publish my thesis. I abandoned my thesis quite happily. But I stayed with the figure of Empson and also the figure of Arthur Eddington, the astronomer who wrote popular works. So it was after the PhD that I started encountering these other genres and talking to people who were working on the popularization of science, and thinking about ways to connect that with the literary texts. So looking at popular science texts as if they were literature, but also trying to go beyond that a little bit and see how there were maybe shared problems that literary people interested in science and scientific people who were interested in reaching broader audiences, were they working on any shared problems? So that was what I was trying to explore by skipping from one genre to the next as I went chapter by chapter through the book. So I really moved away from my literary focus to explore these other genres and then tried to sew them together into some kind of story. So that was the transformation, really. It was just to leave the thesis where it belonged in a drawer and bring a wider world in.
Yeah, it's so great, though, because although you're saying that you abandoned the kind of literary analysis, that sensitivity to the texture of rhetoric and that sensitivity to the texture of argument and to ways of reading really line by line and word by word, different kinds of documents and different kinds of text to tell larger stories and to draw those connections that you're talking about is very much still in the book and is really, I think, a fantastic addition to what would otherwise perhaps in another scholars and, you know, hands who with a different kind of training, what would be a very different kind of a story. And so actually, congratulations on that, because one of the really wonderful things for a reader about the book is this way that you've managed to really not just write a story here that's interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary, but that takes the kind of methodological and conceptual and analytical resources from both of those fields and creates a kind of sort of third meta field that informs both of them. And so...
Oh, well, thank you. And of course, it's not true to say that I abandon literary techniques, because the presiding spirit of the whole study is this poet and critic, William Empson, who not only wrote astonishing poems with really complex astronomical ideas in them, but he also developed methods of literary criticism that were very much focused intensely on textual details and their possibilities. And so I've always been inspired from, you know, from quite an early stage, from when I was 16, I've been completely inspired by his approach to text. And he's very much the guiding spirit in the background of the whole study, even when I'm analyzing the newspapers.
Now, the book, oh, so to get to Empson, we have to start at the beginning. So let's start at the beginning. So the book itself opens in the introduction with a revolution in science, and that's a quote from the book that was reported by newspapers in Britain on November 7th, 1919. And this revolution in science was occasioned by the emergence of the theories of Einstein and Einsteinian relativity. And this is something that then gets elaborated in the book, especially in the periods from kind of the 1920s to the 1930s. Now, you note here in the course of the chapters, in the course of the book, an important transformation. So you're showing here that there's actually a change through the 1920s and 1930s from initially a kind of frustration in the public engagement with Einstein's theories of relativity, with the difficulty of the theory in the 1920s. And this changes later on in the 1930s to an attitude of more kind of openness, more sort of astronomically informed speculation about the cosmos as a kind of fun, popular pastime. So there's really a transformation here, and the book is going to go on to show different moments in this transformation that are embodied in different genres of literature. But as we'll see over the course of the book, these are not separate worlds of discourse. These are worlds of discourse that are very much informed, not just by each other, but also by common analytic threads that you are drawing throughout the book, throughout these and across these different genres. So one of the things that I want to start off by asking you about is just this this diversity of genres that you are bringing to bear in this project from the perspective of the historian's craft, or the sort of the craft of what it is to work with these different documents. So the book covers, just like I said, a wide range from newspapers, popular fiction of various sorts, poems, magazines, and other kinds of documents. How, as an author sort of working on this project, did you manage to work across all these genres? Were there any particular challenges that you can sort of remember or identify in the process of trying to work across these genres? Or did you feel that you came to this with, you know, sort of feeling perfectly prepared to move with fluidity across these? So what was essentially the question is, what was the process of working across these different kinds of documents like for you? And did your attitude toward this change at all in the course of working on this project?
That's a really interesting question. I love it, talking about process, actually. I think it took me a long time, as I mentioned before, because I had to really absorb myself not only in each genre, but and also in the communities who study those genres. So I spent time building networks and talking to astronomers, and I had some wonderfully warm, if sometimes slightly perplexed, responses from the British Astronomical Community, I set up a conference on Arthur Eddington, and I invited them to come along and engage with philosophers and literary critics. And they were incredibly generous. I mean, everyone who I've engaged with through this study has been really tolerant and generous of my odd approaches. And so I spent time having conversations with people who inhabited these different genres. And I've also engaged with people who work in the present with media science by working with the British Science Festival. So that gave me some perspectives on working with newspapers, as well as, listening to what people were saying about the media at popular science conferences. So it's all been about meeting people, not just sitting in archives going through these texts, but also presenting my work in different contexts and having ongoing conversations with people who inhabit the realm of popular science, who inhabit media science, who inhabit literature, poetry, and popular fiction. I guess the chapter where I had less contact with communities of scholars was chapter 3, where I look at pulp fiction magazines. I didn't have an established network, so I'm starting to get area now, but I was more on my own with that chapter. But I didn't feel alone because I love the characters in the stories and the energy that the authors of pulp fiction were bringing. So although I was in the Bodleian on my own for much of that chapter, it was tremendous fun to work on that material.
And it reads that way as well. So so it's clear that that was a fun chapter to work on from the perspective of a reader. Now, one of the terms that you just mentioned in describing the kinds of communities that you engage with was the term sort of popular culture. And I'll focus on the popular part of this. Now, this even though the chapters in the book all look at different people, different genres of reading, there are threads that weave them all together into the same story. And one of those threads is the idea of, the sort of complex and perhaps problematic, in some ways, idea of the popular. Now, you articulate, and this is something also I would love to hear your thoughts on, because at the beginning of the book, you're very careful to articulate an approach toward what we sort of think of as popular culture that's very nuanced. You are very careful to say here that you're not sort of taking for granted the category of the popular, but rather using it to show the ways that it's always conceived and articulated in the tension, in the tension with elite culture. So can you, there's a number of things we can talk about that are related to this as we get into the book, but can you start us off by saying a little bit about that category of the popular? How important is that for you in thinking through these ideas? And can you talk about the kind of ways that you want to kind of complexify or complicate that notion for us in the book?
Well, there have been some suggestions from scholars in the history of science communication that we don't use the term popular science anymore because it's such a problematic category, because it assumes, for example, that there's a sharp division between proper science and popular science, and that therefore popular science is a parasitic activity, it's a secondary activity. And for many reasons, people want to avoid those kind of connotations because the activity of engaging wider audiences with science, or of science coming from those wider audiences, is really complex, and it's a contribution to knowledge in its own right. So that's just one of the reasons why people suggest that we don't use the term. And after some humming and hawing, I decided to retain the term popular science, partly because I'm working on the 1920s and because the term is valid and current for that period, and because of the point that you've just made, that the popular is always in some kind of conversation or tension with notions of an elite. So I decided to keep the term popular science because it was the term on everybody's minds, and it was the term that all the people, it was being explicitly mobilized in problematic ways in all the different genres that I was looking at. So when Einstein's theory first came out, one of the liberal newspapers said, oh, well, surely the death knell of popular science is sounding now, because so that they were referring to the idea that through the 19th century there'd been lots of ways of bringing science into contact with people's lives, but with Einstein's theory, that was just the end, really, that science had disappeared into its specialized realm. So because science was becoming increasingly specialized, increasingly hard to understand even from one branch of science to another, there were lots of concerns about the end of popular science. That very 19th century phenomenon was drawing to a close now that we'd moved into a new century. So people were explicitly confronting the term popular in their own way then, just as we are now in a historiographical way. So that's why I decided to keep it, but to make it a prickly term all the way through the book.
And one of the categories that you bring to bear in sort of giving some texture to this category of the popular is the notion of mathematical innocence.
Yeah.
So can you say a little bit about that and the importance of this notion of mathematical innocence to the way you're thinking about the what we might think of as a popular field in the context of the 1920s and 1930s in Britain?
Yeah, well, I came up with that term because I wanted to have a different term rather than saying lay readers or lay audiences, because that's the term that that's often available for use. We have a contrast between the scientific specialist or the scientifically literate person and the non-specialist or the lay audience. And I wasn't really happy with non-specialists, partly because it's a negative term, but also because it had become really clear to me that the people who were engaging from outside science were specialists themselves in their own domains. So the journalists were specialists in being able to sell newspapers and create attention-grabbing headlines and twist science in with politics. And poets were specialists in bringing surprising or opposite things together, and so on. So they were specialists. I couldn't bring myself to call them non-specialists. And I didn't want to call them a lay audience because I felt that that was importing a sleeping and quite sleepy by now religious metaphor that would carry its own interpretation that I didn't want imported in an automatic way. Well, okay, how can I describe these people? The thing that really distinguishes them from people who are working with theories of space and time is that they're not able to use the specialist calculus that's involved in working with relativity. So I decided that they were mathematically innocent, but they were innocent to varying degrees. So William Empson, he had a mathematics degree, but he's still innocent of the specific calculus that was formed. So he was less innocent than maybe a reader of a pulp fiction magazine who would have a higher degree of mathematical innocence.
Now, you just mentioned the term relativity, and one of the really interesting things that's happening in the book as well is that the concept of relativity is taken up, it's adopted, and it's adapted into very different contexts and used in very different ways. And in fact, you refer to this process by which relativity starts to circulate as a kind of commodification. So you say relativity was actually commodified, it became a commodity alongside others of its day. Can you say a little bit about that? And can you speak to the idea here of relativity as a commodity in this context?
Yes, I think relativity was presented to people in an advertising laden context. So they were reading about it alongside fashion advertisements and alongside adverts that would improve them. So adverts, you too could become a writer, you too could increase your worth. Very explicit adverts about how readers of popular magazines could increase their value in the marketplace. And so I wanted to suggest that relativity was a fashionable thing that you could talk about. It was a commodity that you could incorporate into your conversation. But quite often it was a commodity that could explode in your mouth because of all the problems that came with talking about relativity. If you started talking about it, you would immediately be setting up barriers between yourself and other people, or you might get yourself into trouble by not being able to finish your sentence and be able to explain what it was really about. Or you might end up getting drawn into a conversation about the fourth dimension and all kinds of mystical things. So it was a dangerous commodity for people to talk about, but it was also an irresistible one. Because it was so versatile, I think one of the wonderful things about relativity is that it was so difficult that nobody could actually explain it, which meant that it wasn't really tied down to any particular interpretation, and anybody could do what they wanted with it. So in a way, it's the dream commodity because it can be used for any purpose that the person using it would like.
And one of the really interesting things that later chapters of the book do is exactly to look at the kind of the ways that advertisements specifically on the same pages or in the same publications and perhaps being looked at the same time that readers were looking at articles about relativity, how that process of sort of visually and conceptually juxtaposing advertisements with work on relativity really changed or rather shaped the way readers were experiencing and taking up and understanding relativity as a concept. So there's this really wonderful way that juxtaposition in this way explicitly with advertisements creates knowledge in a way that you're showing very concretely in the pages, certainly of the magazines especially. So that was really interesting. So as we get into to the sort of body chapters of the book itself, we start looking in turn at these different genres that we've been alluding to in the course of our early conversation. The first chapter looks at newspapers in particular. This introduces what you call the Einsteinian sensation by looking at two intense periods of news coverage. First, coverage around the announcement of the eclipse observations in November 1919, and then also coverage around Einstein's visit to Britain in June 1921. Now, this chapter analyzes this coverage in a series of daily newspapers and weekly newspapers. So the dailies include the Daily Mail, the Times, the Daily Express, the Daily News, and the weeklies include three very different kinds of weekly newspapers that are doing different kinds of work. The kind of satirical Punch, the populist Titbits, and the socialist Time and Tide. Okay, so one of the things, so before we get into kind of differences in how these publications are treating this issue, this is all happening in and is being informed by and is in turn informing developments in the contemporary political history of Britain in the early 20th century. So you're showing here how the kind of revolution in science that Einsteinian relativity is functioning as really also went along with a revolution in politics. So can you say a little bit about, and you know, you don't have to go into too much detail, but what was, for someone who may not know anything about what's happening right now in contemporary British politics, or right now meaning 1920s, in British politics that may have been shaping the way readers were taking up the discourse of relativity. What was happening in the political climate of the time that was shaping and being shaped by what's happening in these newspapers?
Well, what had happened in the 19th century was that the British government had flipped back and forth between the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. They had a coalition between the Liberals and the Conservatives, which oddly enough has happened since I finished the book. We've had that again for the first time. But this coalition was in trouble following the First World War. It was in trouble during the First World War. The Liberal Party was really losing decline. It was in decline. It was losing the faith of the people, and it was just declining as an electable party. So after this coalition dissolved, the Liberal Party never again came into power in Britain. They are in power as part of a coalition now, but never again were they that old Liberal Party of the 19th century. And the other thing that was happening at the same time is that the Labour Party was starting to become an electable force. So there was this shift from the liberal conservative back and forth into what's been more familiar through the 20th century, which was a Labour conservative shift back and forth. But this was happening at the same time as revolution in Europe. So the Bolshevik uprising in Russia during the First World War. And obviously this was being covered in the British newspapers and in the press worldwide. So the combination of a shift from away from the liberals and towards Labour in Britain and the revolutions in other countries made people very worried. They really genuinely thought that Britain was going to be overtaken by communists and that there would be a revolution in Britain. And they were genuinely worried that this was a very real prospect. And at the same time, they have a revolution in science. So it was immediately, there was no hope for science to be kept out of politics or to be kept in and discussed separately from politics. That could never have happened purely because of the timing. There's also been quite a lot of discussion among historians of the naming of Einstein's theory and how unfortunate that it was called the theory of relativity, because relativity had quite radical associations in the 19th century as an alternative to absolutes. And so it was very much already entwined in the discussion of values progressive change. So people have said, well, Einstein's theory really should have been called the theory of invariance, which would have been much more boring and kept it nice and safe from getting entwined with politics. But I don't know, to be honest, if that change of name would have helped really.
Thank you so much. So now that the stage is set, one of the things that this chapter does really, really interestingly and makes a very compelling case for is to show how these different newspapers that you're looking at had different agendas and different kinds of audiences and different sort of different things that they were trying to do, both politically but also editorially. And they consequently, the editors and the writers of these pieces and of these newspapers used relativity and covered relativity in different ways to support these very different kinds of agendas and kinds of goals, and to consolidate also their relationships with their readers and their different communities of readers. One of the other things that is really interesting about this story that you're telling in this chapter, though, is that it wasn't just editors and writers who were doing this, but it was also scientists who were using the press in turn, right, to support their views. And this is something I would love for you to talk a little bit about, because this gets us to another concept that's really vital throughout all of the chapters, even though it emerges sort of early on here, and that's the notion of enrollment.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit here about sort of really the ways that scientists are trying to use the press for support, but as a way to talk more broadly about this idea of enrollment? What is enrollment, and in what ways is that crucial for the work that you're doing in the book?
Well, scientists during the 19th century, especially in the second half of the 19th century, had to make increasing use of the press and become increasingly adept at PR because they needed public money to support the science they were doing. Science was becoming a profession rather than a gentlemanly pursuit. And that transformation happened in the early 19th century, but it was an ongoing transformation, an ongoing shift. So it was really important for scientists to impress the public, and the main instrument of doing that, aside from giving talks, was through the newspapers. So just as politicians needed the newspapers on their side, scientists also needed that in order to justify and command public funding. So the concept, this idea of enrollment, I've taken from two scholars called Roger Cooter and Stephen Pumphrey, who they developed this idea in the context of science communication, where they talk about this concept of mutual enrollment. So when a scientist makes an appeal to the public, they enroll the public in their own aims. So the aim might be for them to have a public profile for science and public support. The public becomes part they become enlisted in that endeavour to gain support for science. But they also suggest that enrolment can work the other way, in which case the scientist becomes enrolled in what the public wants. So they might have to be a bit of a compromise in that mutual enrolment. And what I found, I thought, okay, this sounds like a really interesting model for public engagement of science. I'm going to test out this model by looking at the case study of relativity in Britain, and I'll see where it breaks, because every model has a breaking point. That's the difference between a model and the messy business of real life. And I found that what happened was that scientists would enroll the public, but then the scientists would get enrolled in other things that they hadn't wanted maybe to be involved with. So science became an instrument of media promotion. And I'm sure that that wasn't the original aim of the scientists. They wanted to get the public to support them. And so they had to cater to public interests, but science became a method. By covering science, the newspapers could promote themselves as newspapers. So the Daily Mail could do Daily Mailish things with relativity. So my favourite headline in the whole chapter is "Light Caught Bending." It's just such a Daily Mail headline. So every newspaper used relativity as a way of saying to its readers, look, this is what we do with science. This is what we're doing with the latest science story. And this is what we offer to you as our readers. The Times, the real virtue of the Times that it promoted to its readers was that you didn't need anything except the Times, because we will show you everything, every angle on the subject. We will talk all around the subject, so you're informed with a broad scope of opinion and you'll be able to make your own mind up. So the Times had a real bonanza with relativity, and they had the most inconceivable range of content on the theme of relativity. And so each newspaper performs their own relationship with the public, their own promise to the public by how they covered relativity. And I don't think that's a new thing. I think particularly Jim Secord has shown in his research that what it meant to be a scientist and what it meant to be a newspaper were almost twins that grew up together from the early 19th century onwards. They shaped each other. So I'm not saying that this is something new that happened with relativity, but it was very much in action. And it meant that there were lots of surprises in store. Scientists couldn't really control how the newspapers were going to use relativity. And then that set up the problems that then were then encountered when people wanted to popularize relativity in the 20s. They had to unpick this media image of relativity, or media images that had been created.
Now, the next chapter is something that I'll mention but not ask you too much about, so that we can move on to the romance and the work of Eddington, etc. after that. But I'll just mention for listeners that the next chapter moves this investigation into the realm of popular science magazines and looks both at a series of monthly magazines and also other kinds of magazines that represented very different kinds of concerns with class, with labor politics, and you look at the ways that enrollment did or didn't happen, and that and how relativity functions and is treated and emerges as a sort of point of reference in these very different kinds of genres than the newspapers, even though we might typically think of newspapers and magazines in the same mental breath. It's actually, the story becomes quite different from what we see in the first chapter. But what I want to ask you about, or sort of bring us to, is more and more as we get into creative fiction, And the third chapter looks at space and time in pulp fiction and looks at Einstein-themed stories in pulp fiction magazines. Now, can you talk a little bit about the ways that Einstein-themed stories emerge in this genre? And this is a chapter in which you talk about the importance of kind of romance plots in engaging themes of relativity. So how did that work, and how did sort of Einsteinian relativity emerge in this genre as an important way of telling a romance?
There are two types of stories that I found. One was the adventure stories where people would fall through a crack in space and time. They'd undergo some kind of bewildering transition. So those are the adventure stories. And they appeared quite quickly off the mark in the early 1920s. The romance stories that I found come a little bit later in the mid-1920s. I guess it depends whether you're considering the adventures as also romances.
Sure, either one. It would actually be great to hear about either one of those types of stories as they engaged Einsteinian themes, whatever type that you're actually most excited about.
Well, what I was delighted to find in these stories was that they were laying claim to the new space and time on the behalf of mathematically innocent readers. So what had happened in the newspapers and in the popular magazines was there'd been quite a lot of tension because the scientific authorities had said, this theory is too difficult for you and we can't give you access to Einstein's universe. I'm sorry, but if you want to join in, you're going to have to obtain very high level mathematical training, so goodbye. And obviously people weren't satisfied with that, and they said, no, you've got to give us access or we'll devise access on our own terms, which was a horrific prospect to scientific authorities because they didn't want people to make up their own version of science. And so there was a bit of an impasse that developed through the early 1920s, and the impasse could not be resolved in popular science magazines because they had a fairly strict remit to actually depict science in accordance with what scientists thought. So the freeing up of relativity came in these pulp fiction magazines where the remit's very different, and the only rules that the author has to abide by are the conventions of a story. So if there's an adventure story, then people have to step out of ordinary life and make some kind of exciting discovery and either come home safe or not. And in romance plots, people have to triumph, love has to triumph over adversity. So with these rules in mind, it became possible to give people ownership or access to the new space and time. And what I discovered, what I was really interested to find, was that these authors showed that people who had no mathematical training could access the fourth dimension. They could travel in time, and they could be translated across space in Einsteinian ways. And they could do this because they lived in a world that was constantly disrupted in time and space because of the media that they were experiencing, the new media. So the wireless was a relatively recent technology that had begun to crop up in people's homes. And the cinema was another new media technology that they had experience of. And through the cinema and the wireless, people already had contact with distant spaces and with the past and also possibly with the future. And the other way in which people could travel in space and time was in their imagination. So the characters in these stories are credited with knowledge of media technology and with a very powerful imagination that renders them susceptible to being translated in space and time and having these adventures. In reply to the claim that you can't have access to this esoteric science, they said, "Well, I'm sorry, we already do, and this is what happens to us. We already have this experience, and it's a very hands-on, concrete experience in our daily life." So you have advertising executives who fall through trick advertisements in brick walls and end up in savage London being chased by saber-toothed tigers. You have business representatives who pick up strange-looking watches and end up getting the financial news from the future and being able to make lots of money on that knowledge. But then with the romance plots, there was a sense that people having this ability to zoom around in space and time was possibly a dangerous thing. And I think this comes back to the association of relativity with revolution. People could be given access on their own terms, but you had to close that down in a way, because otherwise they might be getting too revolutionary ideas and too much opinion of their knowledge. But it's in the romance plots that this shutting down really happens, and astronomy is presented as a dangerous thing, and characters who are too obsessed with space and time are not able to maintain healthy relationships and get married and have children, and so the astronomy interests have to be over, they are the love obstacle that has to be overcome in order for people to find love and get on with their lives.
It's such great material. It's such a great chapter. So from this chapter, we move to the second part of the book. And the second part of the book features chapters that each look at, rather than looking in particular at a specific genre of work, they look at the work of a particular figure or figures that were crucial to the development of this wider engagement with Einsteinian theories and with relativity in particular in this context. Now, the next chapter brings us to one of the figures that has already come up in the course of our early conversation, and he's absolutely crucial to this story, and this is Arthur Stanley Eddington. Now, this is one of the really interesting things that comes out of this chapter is that he's a practicing Quaker, and the kinds of political and social commitments that come out of that set of practices actually inform the way he interprets and the way he engages with Einstein's idea of relativity. So can you talk a little bit about that? How does relativity offer him a chance to engage his political and social ideas through this set of mathematical concepts?
Well, I couldn't have written this chapter without the book by Matthew Stanley called Practical Mystic, in which he in a very detailed way explores how Eddington's spiritual religious values and his scientific values completely intersected. So for him, there was being a Quaker and being an astronomer were part of the same endeavor of seeking, which is a Quaker term for the way that you come to understand the world and your relationship to it. So I decided that I would take this knowledge that Matthew Stanley had produced about Eddington and I would apply it to his popular writings. So I would show how his values as an internationalist informed the texture of his writing. So in relativity theory, there's this thing called frames of reference. So we're one frame of reference on the Earth, but somebody on the Sun would be in a different frame of reference, and we would measure events and time them in different ways because we're in different frames of reference. And so Eddington would create conflicts between frames of reference, and he would have characters on the Sun and characters on the Earth disagreeing, and he would use his Quaker values to negotiate an understanding between those two perspectives. And so all the way through his popular accounts, there are these disagreements and disputes, and he resolves them, but he uses narrative tension. He uses the techniques of popular fiction to create disagreements and bring them to life so that as readers, we're invested in him finding a solution. So that's a very subtle way in which his Quaker values caused him to borrow very popular techniques to create narrative tension and then resolve it in ways that accorded with his own interpretation of relativity theory.
Great. Now, the materials that you used included in this chapter, not just Eddington's published work, but his unpublished letters and his journal entries. So what kind of perspective or what kind of entry into this set of problems did using those particular kinds of materials give you that, and how did that story engage with what you would have seen in the published materials?
Well, Eddington was a very private person, so there are some quite significant limits on what we can know about him and how we can find out about the inner life that he led. What I wanted to do was to show that Eddington was experiencing everyday life in ways that were comparable to those of his audience. So he was, for example, sugar and butter and things like that were rationed after the war had ended. But when he went on his astronomical expeditions, he was treated to overflowing sugar bowls on board the ship. And this image really stuck with me because I realised that as a scientist, he was not only moving between worlds of the popular and the spiritual and the scientific, but he was also literally on the move as he went on his scientific expeditions. So this is just another side to his ability to speak across the divisions of experience and to be aware of those divisions. And I wanted the physical body of Eddington to be have a presence in the story, and to show how he was very sympathetic and alive to the physical conditions that his readers were living in.
Great. Now, as we come to the end of the book, or the last part of the book, we won't have time to talk about all of the wonderful things that are happening in chapters 5 and 6, especially, but I want to just kind of signal and ask you about one of the things that's happening in chapter 5. This is a chapter that's focused on the work of Dorothy Sayers. And you're showing in here that her engagement with popular physics is part of a series of larger arguments that she's making, or sort of larger issues she's dealing with that have to do with kind of masculine and experience in the post-war. So post-war male disorientation, I think you term it. And she's engaging popular physics as a way of engaging issues of marriage and relationships and the sort of the masculine in this context. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because that might be a kind of surprising connection for readers to find in a book on Einsteinian relativity. So how is, in what ways is that important to the larger story that you're telling?
Well, surprise to me as well, but Sayers was a big fan of Arthur Eddington, and she wrote to her son and said that she really valued the way that he enlarges and disorientates the mind. But in Sayers' books, she uses popular physics as an obstacle to marriage. So in keeping with the popular fiction stories, she has these bachelor characters who are obsessed with time and space and who I've been reading Eddington and who are inhabiting this Einsteinian world, but it's causing them to lose touch with practicalities of life. So these characters have to be rescued from Einstein's universe and so that they can get married. This is always the goal at the end of the story, but it's for Sayers' stories, the marriage is always something that's being delayed or deferred or not quite happening. And so it fits in with the popular fiction stories in that relativity is an exciting new development, but it also it's somehow dangerous, and it can cause people to, if they get too absorbed in the new cosmology, they might lose touch with terrestrial practical realities.
Now, we come now to the last body chapter of the book, and this is, although this is the last body chapter, you've mentioned earlier that it was this topic that actually spurred your interest in this set of issues and this range of questions in the first place, and this is the chapter on the poetic work of the astronomy love poems, which I love that phrase, of William Empson. Now, Empson is well known for his work on the multiplicity of meanings of a word, and as you, I think, phrase it here, the creative power of contradiction, where you talk about his work on contradiction and on multiplicity of meanings. And listeners or readers may be familiar with him as the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity, and there's another book that we briefly talked about this before the interview, but that I had totally coincidentally seen earlier this week, which is his work on the structure of complex words, which Stefan Collini is working on right now. Now, this is a chapter that looks at this wonderful set of engagements with popular science and with physics in particular, and ideas of relativity in these love poems in a really detailed way. And so you're giving us a very textured reading of the lines and sections of these poems as they emerge out of Empson's work. Can you talk a little bit about sort of why he's engaging these themes of relativity in this work? You mentioned a little bit in the chapter that he's inspired by the work of John Donne, who was himself inspired by the new philosophy of Copernican astronomy. But can you speak a little bit to the importance of astronomical themes and of relativity in Empson's poems and the significance of that for the larger argument that you're making in the book as a whole?
Empson really seized upon the new astronomy as a resource for exploring the gaps that appear between people who've been reading different kinds of things, or the gaps that appear in unrequited love affairs, with which he is very much preoccupied as an undergraduate, as many people are. And I think that one of the things he really admired in poetry is that how a poet can take a very personal experience and they can make it powerful and interesting to other people through poetry by using metaphors and analogies and conceits. So, okay, I'm having a terrible love affair, but that's not very interesting to anyone else. But if I use an astronomical metaphor, I can help myself through this difficult time by distancing myself from it. And I can also give my love affair a cosmic significance that other people can participate in. So I think that's the general model that he's using. And so although his poems are far from popular because they're so very difficult, he's very much concerned with the ways in which popular science can have a use and have a life beyond science.
One of the wonderful things, just to sort of put a final point on that chapter, as a reader who came into this knowing very little about Empson, he really emerges from that chapter as someone you'd really want to hang out with. You know, he's just sort of like, I wish that he was around for me to hang out with and have a conversation with. And so I think it's a mark of, I think, incredible success for a writer when you can write a historical figure in that way and have him emerge out of the page and be somebody that readers are really going to want to spend more time with. So I think if this is probably going to be responsible for a lot of historians of science learning a whole lot more about Empson, because he emerges as such a compelling figure in this book that you really want to go on and learn much more about and spend time with. So thank you for that, because you've really inspired me here to go and read a lot more about him. He seems just like a super cool guy. Okay, so we are sort of at the point where we probably should be wrapping up so that I don't take 3 or 4 hours of your time talking about all the wonderful stories that emerge out of the book. I will note for listeners, especially those who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, that there's also this really wonderful conclusion in which you're not just wrapping up the book, but also introducing the work of J.W. Dunn and his book, An Experiment with Time, as a way to think through the stages of relativity's enrollment in the popular culture that you present to us in the book. So, Katie, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about? And like I mentioned, there's an extraordinary number of wonderful characters and stories and themes and concepts in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's a very rich work. Is there anything in particular that we didn't cover but that you'd like to mention for listeners and readers?
We did talk about politics, but just coming back to that, there's this question of the terms on which an encounter between maybe two different areas of authority can happen. So one authority would be the scientific establishment, and another authority would be popular voices. So there are these multiple authorities that come to an encounter, and I think that that's often a journey that can unfold over quite a long period of time. So people, as I mentioned, were unable to have access to relativity, or they were told that they couldn't. And then they found that they had ways around that access. But these were on terms that were quite unfamiliar to those working in science. So I guess my final point would be about conversations across different areas of specialism. And I'm actually very much in favour of specialism. I think it's important that we develop our own specialist skills, but I'm also in favour of ongoing conversations and people taking risks to reach out across those divisions and people having the patience, as they have done with me and my project, to listen to people who are coming from somewhere different. So that would be my final comment, really.
That's excellent. So now that the book is out, and congratulations, it's as I've mentioned before, it's a really engaging, very rich book. What's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you at the moment?
Well, I've been pursuing J.W. Dunn and his experiment with time, and I'm actually quite excited because I've found a stash of letters that were written in the 1960s of people giving their accounts of precognitive dreams they'd had, so dreams that then subsequently occurred in their waking life. So I'm using this archive of about 1,400 letters as the basis for a social history of precognitive dreaming. And it's such a find because you so rarely get to hear what people who are not famous and people who are not published think about science and about ideas that are circulating in culture. I'll keep you posted.
That's a wonderful project, and I can't wait to read that one as well. So best of luck with that. Thank you again, Katie, for taking the time to speak with us today, and congratulations again on a wonderful book.
Thank you very much, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.